Hi, welcome to another episode of the Beyond Blocks podcast, a podcast about Drupal, PHP, open source, and related software development topics. I'm Oliver Davis. Today, I'm joined again by Luke McCormick. How are you, Luke?
I'm great, Oliver. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, we're back on again. You were on with Emma in the previous episode, so it's good to have you back on again. It seems to have a few. Obviously, it's been great to have lots of people, quite a few different guests on the show so far since it started, but a few now have been on multiple times, which I think is awesome.
I hope I get to come back.
Good to have you back. So, for people who maybe haven't listened to that episode, the one previously, do you want to do a short introduction to yourself and what you do?
Okay, well, I am Luke McCormick. I'm CellEar on Drupal.org and various social networks. I am a web, specifically Drupal consultant, although I do other things in the San Francisco Bay Area, which I've been doing for a long time. I've been doing Drupal since about 2009. I am a technically informed business guy. Really, I have a computer science degree from a million years ago, but I mostly do like product management and business analysis, and solutions architect is the title that I usually carry these days. I'm involved in lots of Drupal initiatives. I've helped with marketing for various Drupal cons. I help run the AdCamp annual conference in the Bay Area, and one of the things that I do and that I was on the podcast last time with involves Drupalisms, which is specific words that vocabulary words that the Drupal community uses that baffle the rest of the world, and we're so used to seeing them and hearing them and working with them that we forget. So we've been with that project trying to at least get a handle on them, figure out what they are, figure out what people hear when we say them.
Nodes, that's okay. Views. Those are fun Drupal words. Indeed. Yeah, the last episode with Emma Horrell. I'll put a link to that on the episode for this page. I think the reason I found you first of all, or I think you reached out originally, was about Simplified Drupal website, which mentions Drupalisms as well, I think. So we might talk about that a little bit later on. But today we want to talk about something you've done a bit more recently in a talk you gave at a conference last week.
It is. I can tie those two together.
Okay, cool.
As I said in my intro, I'm a technically informed business guy. I understand Drupal architecture and coding to a reasonable degree, but I'm actually not very good at it myself. Real high performance coders, like you, can keep just a huge amount of detail straight in their heads, and that's just not the way I approach things. So previously, I was doing a project that I'm actually thinking about writing a book, but the sort of test for that book is I have the domain name simplifydrupal.com, and currently it's really just this quick project where in January of 2024, a year and a half ago at this point, just every day in January, I wrote a new idea of some approach that you could take to make Drupal less complicated, because I always notice, I'm aware of sort of the power of Drupal, the ability you have to create really, marvelous user interfaces, pointing and clicking at things. There's just all sorts of cruft that's also there and various things that they get in the way of that a little bit. So each day, and it's up on the site, you can see each of the day's work was a thought about how this could be approached. And I didn't actually realize this as I was doing it, but looking at it afterwards and having, let's sit there for a year and comprehend it. What I realized is that I really strongly brought my perspective as a business analyst and product manager to sort of the conversation. And what it ends up being is kind of a set of guidelines, not for programmers. Programmers are the audience for these things. They end up being guidelines for a site owner about how to communicate with programmers to get what you need, how to structure things and deal with problems in a way that leaves you with a site that you can maintain and continue to make use of, even if you didn't create it in the first place. So we can talk about specific details if we get to that, although I want to get to the new thing before that. But we can talk about sort of some of those specific thoughts, and I'd be interested in your feedback for that. However, let me get to the talk about today's thing. Okay.
Sure.
All right. So kind of it seems like it's almost the opposite side of the Simplify piece I was working on before, but I have recently almost accidentally stumbled into using AI tools to help with web programming. And it's been, for me, a really dramatic change in my capabilities. Whereas before, I could eke out a module if I really tried. but I don't know, I don't have you know, in my memory, at my fingertips, the way you do, you know, the myriad of Drupal programming patterns and, you know, all the things you have to know. But I discovered, I discovered that the AI tools do know that.
Are there particular tools, like particular browser or text editor or something? Is that what you mean, or something?
There's two that I use more than others, but I'll touch on other things because it is relevant to lots of them. Mm-hmm. But this whole thing started. I should mention I gave a talk on this on Friday at Stanford WebCamp, and the video's up. Perhaps you put that in the show notes.
Yep.
A link to that. But this all started two months ago, almost by accident. I had the ChatGPT desktop client open on my Macintosh, and I was frustrated with something that I've been frustrated with, you know, since I started with Drupal. Like, you're very familiar with how you have to clear caches all the time. Constantly. It's like you have to clear cache. And I've never been able to find anybody to tell me why specifically. Like even the best Drupal programmers I know, typically, I mean, something, if you're like, you know, redoing, you know, your Twig templates or something like that. But there are just many, many times when you're like, I may or may not need to clear cache, so I'll just do it. So I was thinking, like, you know, I wonder if there's any tool could have something showing up on my Mac display that tells me, you know, how dirty my cache is. What does it look like? So I just typed to the ChatGPT prompt. I said, you know, are there any, you know, modules or other Drupal tools that can tell me what's in the cache? And it responded, you know, looked on the web for a little bit and responded, no, there don't seem to be anything like that. And you know, so I disappointed for a second. But then to my astonishment, it's like, it starts saying, you know, if you were to write one, you would do this. And it spits out like two pages of code. And, you know, I'm amazed by this. So I say, could you package that into a downloadable zip file for me? And it goes, sure, here you go. And, you know, 10 seconds later, a link appears. So I click on the link, download it, pop it into, you know, a GDEV Drupal site that I had running on my desktop out there, enabled it. I went to the extensions menu, you know, there it is. Enabled it, it enabled cleanly. It offered a block, so I placed the block, and there it is. It's listing, you know, the contents of the cache tables. So, you know, I had this experience, this module I've been thinking about writing for over a decade.
Wow.
And you know, just casually, in literally like 3 minutes, mm-hmm. it wrote it for me.
So that's cool.
I gave it two more props. I said, well, you know, can you make a page that does this, you know, mm-hmm. rather than a block, and boom, there it is. And then here's the best part. I said, can you write some tests for this too? Mm-hmm. And you know, it created the tests. Now, I don't, cool. I'm not enough for a program to actually know if the tests work right, but yeah. You know, they're there. Okay. I can show it. So in like 5 minutes, I had something that's kind of ready to be contributed to Drupal.org, like awfully close. So that was the beginning of the task. And since then, I've drifted more into the editor based tools.
Okay. I'm not particularly strongly opinion. It tends to be the thing with the AI things. A lot of people are very much for or against it, and I'm still a little bit on the fence. I don't use it for like in NeoVim or anything to do any sort of completion. That's why I see a lot of people using it. I do sometimes try using it as almost like peer programming, to ask questions and do. And I generally have quite a mixed experience with it. So sometimes it will give me most of, but I don't very rarely do I go to it with a blank canvas. Usually I've got some sort of error that I'm trying to debug, or maybe I'm trying to write a thing and I'm probably 90% of the way through it and I can't quite get the last bit. It gives me that bit. I have good results with it as well, but I've also had some, you know, not good results with it as well. And it does get a bit, I've had situations where it just starts arguing with itself as well, which is like, it suggests a thing and then I say, no, that doesn't work. It suggests something else. And then it suggests the original thing back to me again. I personally have quite mixed results with it from what I've used, but I'm also aware that it's always sort of improving and getting better. And I'm quite curious to see with the Drupal CMS and that project, how AI sort of become integrated into that. And I saw James talk about it.
Well, that's kind of a different use. You know, they're getting into the user interface. I think I'm actually, I mean, it increases my productivity just tremendously. Yeah. And I may just happen to be on the sweet spot where I'm the ideal customer for this. For most of my career, I've been a somewhere sitting between like the product owner, business users, and the actual programmers. So I've tended, you know, I write a lot of specs and I write acceptance tests. And I do the acceptance testing a lot of times on the teams that I'm on. And so traditionally, I would, you know, write up a user story and the acceptance test and hand that over to a programmer. And then a few days later, I get back the results and then I check against the acceptance tests and, you know, decide whether to commit it into the project. But now, I can cut out that programmer. And, you know, I don't, you know, I I don't want to make it sound like I'm trying to make actual programmers unemployed. My guess is that, you know, you guys, they will up the game and do other things. But in terms of what I'm doing with my own things, it enables me to get close enough. And you're right, it makes not just mistakes, but it makes hilarious mistakes.
I like it starts apologizing, and it's like, yeah, you're right. Yeah, it's a little bit funny.
It'll suggest using, you know, it'll give you a drush command that doesn't exist.
Yeah. I've had it with some Terraformers and Nix things recently, and it's, yeah, run this, and it just doesn't, yeah, that doesn't exist. And it goes, oh, yeah, sorry about that.
It's funny because the LLMs really, like, they do not understand anything.
Mm-hmm.
They take, you know, all of language, and they'll process the question that you give them, and then they'll come up with something that, like, basically sounds like the answer. And without knowing what they're saying, they'll just spit out, some things. But they're so incredibly good at it that it'll come out, you know, as, you know, working compilable code, which is remarkable. Apparently, the AI researchers, I've been looking into this, have been astonished at how well LLMs write code. Like, they did not expect it to be able to do that. Mm-hmm. They thought it would be getting answers that can talk to humans and kind of, you know, walk you through things.
Yeah.
But if you ask them, you know, would this be able to write, you know, a 5,000 line program that actually works, they'd be, no, it's not going to get through that. But it does, which is completely remarkable.
How much of that, I wonder, is because there is a large amount of open source code, like obviously Drupal itself, but there are just projects on GitHub that companies may not have trained AI models on. So obviously it's been able to go through and process and pass all that code. So it's had a lot of input and from that side. So maybe that's, but I guess not just code as well. Like, if people, like my blog posts and things were all, still used to be in the GitHub repository. But, you know, it's still able to scan those. And you know, it's got all that knowledge as well. So yeah, no, that's a...
So I'll tell you the kind of thing that it's super useful for. I mostly these days use Cursor.
Okay,
which I'm sure you're familiar with.
Not really. I've heard of it, but not too familiar. So maybe you could just explain that.
It's Visual Studio Code with a chat window integrated into it. And for what it's worth, they were bought last week by OpenAI, the ChatGPT people, for $3 billion.
Wow.
Which, you know, has to be a new record for, you know, a plugin for an open source editor, basically.
Yeah.
Wow. So, I mean, Cursor has in the past mostly used Claude, which is Anthropic's thing. But it's funny, I can already feel the differences because I was using Cursor in my demo on Friday at Stanford. And I asked a question I've asked it many times, which is, what model are you using? And when I'd asked it in the past, it had responded, you know, I'm using Claude Sonnet 3.1 or, you know, whatever. But on Friday when it did, it said, I can't take that. So, I think OpenAI has already started to put its, you know, pieces in for better or worse. I mean, I'm not happy about that change, but I'm sure there'll be other positive aspects to it.
So when you say it's VS Code with a chat window, so I'm imagining sort of code on the left and almost like where the minimap usually sort of is on the right-hand side, there's a section there. So in
exactly
the typing, you typing, write me a bit of code that does this, and then it makes the code on the left-hand side for you, or?
Yeah. It's better than that, actually. So generally, you know, my workflow, there's lots of ways to do this, but I'll get to the directory where my ddev, you know, code base is, and say, you know, cursor dot on a Mac, which will open up cursor on that directory. And your code becomes the context. And I'll typically tell it where I am, although you could probably figure it out. It's good stuff like that. But I'll say, hey, you know, we're in a, you know, Drupal 9 site. And one thing I've done successfully, I'll give you actually here an example, is the 7 administrative theme that was, you know, initially released for Drupal 7 and, you know, maintained, I think it was in core for Drupal 8 and made, you know, taken out of core, but existed as a contrib theme in Drupal 9 and 10. There's no downloadable Drupal 11 compatible version of 7. But I went into Cursor, just dragged, you know, a Drupal 10 compatible version of 7 into my themes folder, which, of course, you know, the Drupal 11 extensions window says, you know, this is not compatible with this version of Drupal, you know, bad luck. So I just saved the chat window in Cursor. I put a Drupal 10 compatible version of the 7 theme into this code base. Can you update it to make it compatible with Drupal 11? And, you know, it goes, it scans it, it reads the things, it goes and checks the notes up, you know, to find out what's compatible and what's not. And in the case of the 7 theme, it actually literally just, you know, rewrote the line in 7.info.yaml and just added 11 to the list of compatible things, which seemed to work. But I've done the same thing with modules. So I've asked it to create an updated version of the module. And I mean, you've done that a bazillion times, right? And you know the process. You know, it takes you more than 5 minutes to do it. But Cursor will go in and make the changes, and it's very friendly. It'll bring up the files that it changes. Like it goes into your code base and finds the files. It'll bring them up in the editor and then offer you a dialogue. It'll show you the changes in a diff and ask if you want to accept them. So I'm not doing vibe coding. I'm not doing trusted stuff. Like I look at every line that it changes and understand it. And it's definitely not hacking my bank account, because I've read those lines of code and they're not hacking my bank account. I know what they're doing.
I think that's crucial. I think that's something I was saying with someone recently. Even if code is still AI generated, if you're not taking the time to go through and read and understand it, then it's not an AI specific problem, because people could still be doing that from Stack Overflow or from Google or from anywhere else. So the fact that it's AI generated doesn't make it bad. It's still wherever you're getting that code from, you should be reading, understanding it, and not just taking it as gospel that it works and using it without doing that, in my opinion.
I mean, there's a huge advantage of doing it for code versus doing it for lots of other things. I see on social media all the time, people will, in an argument, will put some AI-generated answer out as proof of something. And AI will just make things up. It only guarantees that it sounds right. It doesn't guarantee at all that it is right. So if you're asking about, a historical event, you're taking big chances as to, whether it's hallucinating or not. However, the code... You run it, you check it, you send it through your tests. We have, all sorts of ways to verify that it's actually correct. And we can use those. And using that, it works. It doesn't get the ability of someone who really has no idea to get things done, because it often will solve a problem 95% of the way, but for that other 5%, you need to check its work sometimes, you need to suggest things. It's funny how light it is. It keeps apologizing for making mistakes and stuff.
Well, I was going to say it's the same as working with a colleague or a junior fellow or anybody else, and not the fact that it's apologizing, but it's still, it's a tool that it's there, and it gives you that first iteration, if nothing else, for you to then take and keep iterating on. I think that's where people were maybe, or developers were maybe sort of worried when this is also starting, that people, about clients essentially, or potential clients, would, instead of going to developers and saying, I want a website that does this, they would just ask ChatGPT or some AI model and it would do it for them. I think, like you said earlier on, that you're the right target market because you know enough to ask it the right things. So you can give it as much context or the right type of context. You're not just saying, make me a mobile app that does blah, 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 then, and that doesn't have any context around that. So maybe that's why you're also getting slightly better results from it.
Well, I'm particularly well suited to that, because before this, the whole simplified Drupal thing, I had thought long and hard about how you keep experts under control. Not wanting to abuse them, but just not be abused by them. And the same techniques that I came up with to keep gurus from running wild work pretty effectively, keeping LLMs from running wild. I constrain them for what I want them to do. I check the results. I insist on the things that I want. Let me give you an example that will even warm your heart as a coder, right? Because I'll tell you something that I've had the AIs do that you can do, but you don't want to do.
Okay, I'm curious. Go on.
Writing documentation. So I learned to program, back a million years ago in like the Neolithic era, and at the particular time that I was in computer science school, we were drilled heavily about commenting all our things. We were supposed to put a paragraph long comment at the beginning of every procedure, we called them in those days, functions, methods, and comment each line of code and all sorts of stuff. And nobody does that anymore. And it's annoyed me for years, because I read, I look at code, and I looked at like a zillion contributed modules where literally not a single comment is anywhere in any of the code. And
self-documented code is the
coders will say it's self-documenting, it's just readable. I'm calling boulder dash on that. It's just laziness. However, instead of having to get into like a shouting match in the break room over it now, the AI codes do brilliant documentation. When I inherit a site that has 10 custom modules, I will feed it in and tell it, for each of these modules, tell me, write some documentation, tell me exactly what it does, tell me what the variables it's affecting are, tell me what it depends on, document each function, tell me what its purpose is, and it will happily write levels of documentation. It'll document the code with, you know, comments to whatever verbosity I want. It'll write a README. It'll write a user guide. It'll write a change log. It can read the Git histories and tell you who did what.
Yeah.
But all sorts of things that you could do, you know, yourself, but you're not going to.
Yeah,
Your
it's a
time
good
is
idea.
valuable for that.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's definitely, there's been times where I've joined projects or ongoing projects and had to figure out lots of things for myself. But yeah, having just like an AI go like and ask it, yeah, summarize all these modules for me and tell you what they do. Yeah, that would be a very good idea. Interesting. I hadn't thought of that.
Here, I'll give you an example that I think you'll be familiar with, where, you know, let's say you have a config from a different Drupal site, and you want to import a feature from one site to another. Now, I'm sure you've experienced when you do that just blindly, you just copy the config YAML files, Drupal complain that the UUID is wrong, that it's,
Yes.
that, you know, from a different thing. And you can scream at it and be like, you know, I know, but I want you to do that. And, you know, Drupal doesn't care. It's not going to help you. But drop it into Cursor. And tell it that, you know, Drupal said this, and say, you know, can you fix these YAML files so that they will work with this Drupal thing, with this Drupal installation? And it will dive in and look up the old UUIDs and rewrite the new ones. And, you know, it'll work like 90% of the time, maybe even less, right? Like, it definitely screws up. It doesn't always do it. You have to, you know, that's why it's not vibe coding. You have to kind of know what you're doing. You have to know how to check it. You can't trust it because it'll say done when it's in fact not done.
Yeah.
So you do have to check. You can't take its word.
Yeah, I have also, you mentioned testing earlier on. I have had issues, but I have asked it before to write or have a problem with the test, and it suggested deleting the test. Yeah, that's not what I
That
meant.
worked out all
Yeah, I
right.
mean, technically it fixes the problem, but yeah. Whereas, yeah, I could see that being, like I said earlier on, like if you said, write me some tests that do this, and then you sort of reviewed them, saw and idea what it was doing, and then said, these look good, now generate the code for them. Like I said, taking that time just to read, parse, and understand, not just go, yep, they're good, and just generate everything is done. And yeah, that's something I've seen with yeah, from what little I've learned about so far is like having a human in the loop. And I think that's where you know, I think we're quite good and quite transparent, at least in Drupal, about which bits are AI, which bits aren't. And yeah, I think what you're saying is the right thing. Yeah, I think it's yeah, not just go, yeah, it's done and then moving on. Yeah, I'm sure there's lots of use cases, like you said, for documentation and things I hadn't thought of. The
I really,
modular
I
thinking
just,
was interesting.
I encourage everybody to try it, because it's too different. If somebody describes it and you, like, as a thought experiment, think of how this would work, you're not going to get it right. You have to get your hands on it to feel it do things, because it just got different spikes than you expect. It's good at things you don't expect it to be good at. It's bad at things you think it's going to be good at. And it's really surprising. Like, it gets easy things wrong sometimes. I mean, you know, they're not like subtle, they're giant obvious things wrong. So it's hard to predict what it's going to do, but it's easy to see. It's easy to just, you know,
Yeah,
watch it.
like you said, for
So
something like for coding, where you can run it and say, does it work? Or you've got a test that you can run and now it fails or doesn't work. Then, yeah, it's quite obvious, I guess, whether it's right or not right, if it's something that's more subjective.
yeah, I can see, I can see it on the podcast, but I can see you thinking, like, when I said that bit about, you know, you can update, it'll update a module for you. I can see you go, wait, really? It can do
So
that?
what I was thinking with that is, so there is like automated patches. So we have Rector, which is a PHP tool that goes through and will do patches. So I use it a lot for its primary use case, I guess, is updating code between different PHP versions. So now I'm on, I've moved from 8.1 to 8.3. I can use promoted constructors or whatever the new thing is between that version, and it will essentially rewrite your code. So it uses all the new features of the new thing. Matt Glamman's done PHP Stand Drupal, so now it knows about Drupal things, and you know, Rector and then that and PHP Stand, I guess, are generating, or I guess Rector also is writing patches, automated patches. So what you said about updating, I said, like, well, does that mean, like, could that be another thing that does that? And do we end up with Drupal issues with sort of automated patches but generated from AI rather than generated through something like Rector?
Certainly.
Little note
Look,
that says, you know, this patch is generated by AI. I think, you know, that doesn't seem inconceivable that that could happen.
Well, I mean, it's just the next generation of what we've done for years, right? You know, like there's, you know, going back to 50 years ago, you know, people point out that you can make a change in a document by global replace, right? Like, at one point, global replace was magic. Take this word out and swap in this other word. And, you know, it is kind of magic. It's a lot easier than doing it, you know, on a typewriter. But you do it and you learn the problems, right? You learn that it replaces the word even if it's in the middle of another word and gives you, like, nonsense results and doesn't understand context. So, you know, the AI tools are similarly, you know, adding power. You know, you don't want to, like, use a chainsaw with a blindfold, right? You need to be careful of these things.
Yeah, it's not a good idea.
You know, you keep your eyes open, and you find that it's really powerful. Use it for your next project to write a README for the file. Your clients will love it.
I might do that after this, actually. Yeah, I was thinking. So thinking my previous thought about the like AI generated projects. Last time we were talking about drupisms and avoiding certain words, maybe in documentation like views or nodes or something. Like, could you even have like an AI thing checking modules and say, ah, that's a drupisism. Don't use that word. Don't use the word node in your README. Because that would be better than to suggest almost like an alternative to that, because it's going to be more context aware than just trying to sort of do like a standard sort of string replace or something. Like, it's say, yeah, if you're an AI model on LLM sort of reading it and going, actually, this here's a rewritten README page with less drupalisms in it. Yeah, that would be
Absolutely.
interesting.
I mean, you could learn to control the prompts. I'll give you one thing that I learned to do with every day I'll fire up, a dozen new ChatGPT conversations. And I always, the first thing I always say, and this will show I'm kind of an unsophisticated user because, the real Ivy Tower pros build this into the tools and settings. I just do it by hand. I'll say as my first sentence, I would like you to keep your answers short and concise. Just answer the question and don't give me suggestions unless I ask for them. And it won't respond. If you don't do that, it'll spit out like page after page of suggestions. And so that kind of reels it in.
So that's just you typing into kind of prompt engineering, I think, is a whole thing, right? I've seen things where people are sort of like passing almost like, I don't know, like JSON files into like a request or something. It seems quite technical, but it sounds like you're just giving it the first part of your conversation is almost setting the stage for how you want it to sort of answer what you're doing.
Well, as you've probably picked up, I'm kind of a populist here, right? I push back against kind of ivory tower approaches. I know lots of gurus. I am a guru in various aspects, and I try to control myself. It's pretty tempting. It's pretty hard to resist trying to sound really smart, right? So even if something's easy, you're tempted to try to take it to another level, but you should just be aware of how much of that is actually improving efficiency versus how much is just showing off. Or, how much is really necessary. There's been a controversy recently that I've seen where people complain about, I think Eric Altman actually from OpenAI complained about this, about people saying thank you and please to
Yeah, I
ChatGPT.
saw this, yeah.
And that's, wasting cycles. I don't know if I want to, challenge Eric Altman on this, but honestly, I find that the responses tend to echo how I talk to it. So I say please, and I say thank you. And I'll use, smiley faces and emoticons and stuff. And it responds back to me like the way I speak to it. It will, compliment me on things and, give me heart emojis when something goes well. Like it seems to echo the way you respond to it. So that's one side. And then there's a more practical thing. Like we don't know how these things work. We don't know how they get their answers. So I'm convinced, maybe I'm wrong, but my belief is that the polite stuff, the please and thank yous and, on and on and on, conveys information. It conveys things, what's important to me. It conveys things I'm not sure about. It gives it information that it might be using to give me better answers. Hard to tell, but I don't
So if you say please and give you a better answer. Or something like that,
That kind of, I mean, it might track, for example, when I say to please do something versus when I just like throw it into a sentence. Like maybe the thing I say please is more important. I should give it more weight.
little things like that, subtle things like that are interesting. I was speaking to Dave Liddiman, I don't know, on the podcast or when he's giving one of his talks at a group, he'd mentioned about find versus get, which is something I hadn't really thought about, but it was all to do with finding implies there might not be something, but if you've got a method called get something, that means there is one. And it's a really small subtle change, but when they pointed it out, I went, oh yeah, that makes sense. So yeah, there's little things like that where you say, please or thank you or not to an AI, whether they, what effect is that having behind the scenes?
I mean, this opens up sort of another can of worms. But naming, you're familiar with in the beginning of lots of projects, there's discussions about how things should be named often, right? Like the terminology for a project. And you'll often hear people complain about this. Like it doesn't matter what the variables are called, the computer doesn't care, why should I care, blah, blah, blah. But I mean, there's a reason why we don't sit down at the terminal and just type 0001100110000111100. I mean, that's how it's thinking, right? Like that's what's in its mind. But we don't use those terms because for us, it helps to have a better sense for things. And it comes up in terms of drupalisms. Even now, it just breaks my heart when I see sort of bad terminology leaking in. I'll give you an example. Single directory components, right? You already remember them. You know what they are. They're very useful. What a terribly named thing. Who came up with that? Like, what on earth does that mean? Why could you call them mini themes or something like that? I saw somebody suggest that.
Many
Similarly,
things is hard,
bundles,
isn't
right?
it? What's the other thing?
Well, you talk about bundles, right? Like when I remember the first time I heard bundles, it made my head explode. Because like, it's not from a user's perspective. A node or a taxonomy term or things like that, those kind of make sense in human terms. Like bundle describes like behind the scenes stuff, right? It describes to a programmer how you put that together. And that shouldn't matter, right? That should never leak out to somebody who didn't have to fuss with that. It there should be some name that describes, like, entity. And the problem is we've used up all the words, right? So we have to reuse them. but it should. Like, there's nothing inherent about a bundle once it's been bundled that you can't unbundle it, right? Like it is what it is, and it should be treated as kind of an atomic concept, not as, you know, a historical reference to what you did when you first wrote it.
Oh, that's what your bosoms get in there. Yeah, yeah. When you say bundle, I was thinking about Symphony bundle because in some old divisions of Symphony, they would have, like, their modules were called bundles. So that's what my mind went straight away. But almost Symphonyisms rather than Drupalisms. But
I mean, that's a thing too, of course, right? Like when you use multiple systems, they each have their own vocabulary. And one thing I noticed as an old timer, like if you talk to somebody who just learned programming and ask them how to make a comment, you know, they'll laugh at you. It's like the easiest possible thing. Like, you just put this character and then everything after it gets ignored, right? But ask me to put a comment in, like, Python or something I haven't really used much. And, you know, I've learned, like, 20 or more different comment characters. And I'm like, I don't know, is it slash slash? Is it slash star? Is it,
Then you get ones like PHP where you could do double slash, or you could use, like, the hash symbol. Yeah, it's like, well, when should I use that versus this one? And, yeah, it's one of the original things for me when I was learning was, like, why is this variable called V and K and X? And you know, it's just convention, and that's usually what the documentation was written by. But what I'm sort of aware of, I tried to, it's like foo and bar. I try and not do those in them, because again, like, I think they mean something to programmers and developers, but not to video. Oh, the one, yeah, I was speaking to a group of students the other day, and doing a computing qualification, like asking to speak to them about web development. So we're doing slides, and I was doing some demos, and I put some Laura Mipsum on the page, like, not thinking about it, just so I had something to show in style. And one of the people said, what does that text do? And I was just realizing, yeah, it's just sort of this concept that, you know, we just use it in tech, and that's what it was. But I've seen things online where people I've seen issues made where people have said, I think I've broken the website because I clicked this button and now it's all in Italian, or obviously don't know which language it is. But it's just because it's been used as a placeholder and they've not realized. But inside our little developer bubble or design bubble, you know, it's just a thing that we do. And yeah, just like to everybody else outside, they don't understand what that is.
Yeah. All right. So we're getting to the end of the timeline, but let me, I feel like I've opened up a lot of threads. Anything you want me to tie down before we...
No, I think I sent the link to the talk, so I'll go and watch that. That was web coding for non-coders using AI. So I know, watch that after this, and I'll put a link to that in the show notes, the episode notes. And yeah, it's been really good to speak to you again. And yeah, there's a couple of simplified Drupal things. Like, don't give programmers access to your website. That's the one that sticks out for me.
Well, there's a lot of things in there, and you know, I'll try to be funny, right? You know, they all have the goofy pictures on them, and I was trying to be provocative, and I'd love to actually kind of talk to them and say what I mean. So a bunch of them are things that I've never actually tried. I was coming up with a new one each day, so, and sometimes it was getting towards the end of the day, and I had to think of something quick. Like, they're not all brilliant. But, you know, over the course of them, and
avoiding Drupalisms, so that obviously ties back what we're seeing a little bit. You know, one of them is ChatGPT, so you obviously think about AI obviously back then as well. So,
yeah, I'm actually surprised I said that. That seemed like a long time ago. You know what? I want to give you kudos. One of your daily notes, like, has changed my life. Where you suggested not giving the M flag when you make a Git commit, and just typing commit and having it open up the editor and typing a longer commit comment.
Yep.
And that warms my heart. I mean. Linus Torvalds, you know, Linux creator, said the same thing. So it was a very good company there. But I've been doing that, picked it up. Every so often I'll still do an M, I bet you do too.
That's one of those things. For me, that's new. And then, for other people, though, maybe haven't. I see a lot of when people are learning to use Git, maybe it's in the documentation to use it. And people just don't know that you don't need to pass an M, like the -M flag. And they're like, you don't need to do that right now. So, some little things that, because I know, like, everything's easy when you know it, I guess. So, like, people don't know that, or maybe forgotten. And I think that's where. This is why I keep records. I write my own sort of notes that I keep as well as, like, the ones I publish. Right? I keep like a wiki essentially of things just so I remember them, and this is why I write. But yeah, this is where I think AI could be quite useful to sort of learn and remind everybody of little things you may have missed or forgotten.
I encourage you to get the desktop client book. What do you use for your desktop? Do you have a Linux machine?
A Linux machine. I mostly code in the OVM. But I do, I can install other things as well. But I'll have to, Cursor is one I've seen but not used, so I'll have to. Let's see if I can.
Yeah, Cursor, and I want to mention Windsurf too. They look very similar, but honestly, they run out if you don't pay for them. Like, they'll let you do some stuff with the version, but I pay $20 a month for Cursor, and then I use it all day, and it doesn't seem to run out. So that seems like enough. But they both offer a certain amount of things. And Windsurf right now is offering kind of promotionally, you know, trying to compete with Cursor. They're offering some free access to things. So I think if nothing else, it's worth it to download those to let Windsurf's VCs subsidize your programming.
Mm-hmm. So they have been spoke with a bit recently, setting up local elements rather than going out to ChatGPT or something.
Yeah.
And that's based on NixOS, so it's really straightforward to it's essentially, I think, just services.olambda.enable equals true, and that sets up everything behind the scenes. There's one for open web UI, which looks very much like ChatGPT.
I started to experiment with that, and I understand the appeal. I think it's a great thing to do.
Yeah, so that's quite good. Then scroll through these lists of different models, and like you said, with Claude and also other ones that are in there, I'm looking, almost off a choice now because there's so many different ones in there. But yeah, at my
you're going to Hugging Face, and you'll see hundreds.
Yeah, so I think that's a bit of research then to go into, like, which ones are better for coding, which are better for this. So there's a whole rabbit hole, it feels like, and sort of going down and loading. Yeah, that would, well, like you said, if it's saying, oh, I can't tell you which model I'm using now, maybe it's, sorry, I can't recommend any other types of models because I don't know, it would be interesting.
You could probably work around it. You'd be like, what does another LLM say is the model you're using or something like that, right? One of those.
Yeah, I've heard of things about when people asked it about movies or TV shows, things that said you copyrighted, and said, you can't use that name because it's copyrighted, but then you sort of change it slightly, and then it goes, actually, I can tell you about that. I don't know.
There's all sorts of holes. We're working with you then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think it's going to be see where this is in a couple of years' time from where we are now. Someone's talking about AI and the ones that aren't very good, because there's new ones always coming out all the time, and when that's version 1 of this thing came out, it was really good, but now version 4 is so much better than version 1 was. So yeah, it'd be interesting to see where this ends up in a few years, and what we're going to do with that. Yeah, especially if they're being pulled out by big things, like what does that mean for all? So
start telling now, start getting familiar. You're gonna need to like it.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's definitely something to try and look at more, but for me, not trying to be too reliant on, I still want to keep some of my debugging skills that I go just asking. I do see some people do every little thing, they chat GPT, and I do wonder whether you sort of then forget almost some of those sort of skills then. That's maybe just me.
Yeah.
Awesome. So I'll put the link to the talk. Where can people find you online if people want to get in touch?
That's a reasonable question. My homepage is down right now, but I should fix that. Maybe I'll ask some of the AIs to tell me. Let's see, what's the best way to reach me? I'm on Drupal Slack. If you're listening to this and you want to reach out to me, you're probably on Drupal Slack too. Just hit me and I'll say hello.
Cool. Well, thanks for joining me today, and then thanks for joining me previously. And thanks, everybody, for listening to the Beyond Blocks podcast. I've been Oliver Davis.
Thanks, Albert.